Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, going to spend a little time talking about the decision to allow Detroit to go through bankruptcy. More of the let's run government like a business. Let's Romnetize America. And really what this is, and you know, and we'll go into it a little bit later, but really what this is allowing and forcing government into the same position that we've allowed corporate America to get away with. And that means that if you've got a pension anywhere, it's not secure anywhere. And then Social Security, you're next. Because if they can do it at the state levels, what's to say, hey, you know, we got this Social Security thing, you know, we're just going to have to cut benefits. Because if they can start doing this at the state level, where does it lead? Also going to talk about more privatization schemes on the horizon. But is it good for the nation? Is it good for our country to privatize what we, the people, used to do for ourselves? Is it good for taxpayers? And we know that it's not good for taxpayers. Who we know it's great for? We know it's good for the corporate bottom line, though, isn't it? It's good for profits. It's good. You know, I love when they tell me, we just want competition. Yet you read some of these contracts, these privatization scheme contracts, and there's no competition there. They've contracted all of that right out. But here's the thing. Corporate America loves it, and who doesn't love guaranteed profits? I wish I could get some of those sweet gigs that our corporate friends get, which takes me back to I should be able to be a corporation then. If they can be people, I should have kind of the same rights. And as technology grows, do you still have rights? If it's not the retail industry tracking our every purchase and our every movement, it's our government under the guise of, well, we're just keeping you safe. How far should it go? How far should we allow it to go? I mean, Amazon's talking about delivering packages with drones. Who's to say? While they're delivering the package, because do you remember the plan during the Bush years, right after 9/11? They wanted to have newspaper delivery people and cable people and you know the telephone guy who'd come into your house. They wanted to snoop in on each other. Remember that? They were going to actually, you know, they set up a program to where they were training cable repair people, the installation folks, to come in and snoop on you and then make reports. And it basically flopped because as a country, we go, well, we're not going to spy on each other. Not in large numbers anyway. Now, if we put drones everywhere, well, maybe we can spy on each other more effectively. And on the state level, there's a couple of pieces of legislation that are going to allow policemen to wear cameras on their bodies. And we're going to talk about that. And because if I can't record them, I'm sorry, should they be able to record me? I don't know. Also, more on free trade. Heading toward a record trade year, but not a good year. And the war on workers continues, pensions under assault, and the corporate class defending a low minimum wage. We're going to take your thoughts, your questions, your comments. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me during the program at rick@therickSmithShow.com. So is everybody kind of recovered from the thankless Thursday, Black Friday, silly Saturday weekend? Have we recovered? Have we looked at our checkbooks? Are we about ready to go out and do it again? I sure hope not. I'm hoping this weekend's a little friendlier on the roads. The holiday weekend, not such a good weekend. But I hope everyone recovered, back to the normal grind of things. I know I coach girls basketball. My daughter is, you know, in sixth grade, so I coach the girls' team. A little sluggish coming by back. You know, a couple of girls complaining, had a little bit too much pie, a little too much turkey. But, you know, a little sluggish coming back, worried about this weekend's game. Good news for those of you who are the let's give more money to corporate America. WITF here in the area reported that Pennsylvania has been asked to compete for another Boeing assembly plant. Yes, we can give our tax money to Boeing, and maybe they'll bring some jobs here. And according to the spokesman for the governor's office, the spokesperson for the state Department of Community and Economic Development, the governor is very interested. interested in the potential that it may create jobs. Because remember, Governor Corbett is the more jobs governor. You know, he's told us that a number of times, the more jobs governor. And, you know, more than Wyoming, and that's more than somebody. But not what they would have you believe. And if you remember, we talked at length about the 200,000 jobs that he claims he's created. Not quite so much the job creation that he would have us believe. You look at the Marcellus Shale, and you know, it has created some jobs, admittedly. Not 200,000. They're talking in the tens of thousands, not in the hundreds. And I guess this comes back down to what we've been spoon-fed. We've been spoon-fed this belief that handouts to these companies and these enticements, if you will, are what creates jobs. If we have low tax rates, that's going to create jobs. If we're business-friendly. Which business-friendly, understand, means you have very poor working conditions, low wages, no real benefit structure, and weak unions. That's kind of the competitive angle that corporate America loves. And I just saw this new report out by the Center for Effective Government. And, you know, they've highlighted what I've been saying for years on this program. Those companies that are set up on handout models, those companies that are set up on, we're going to jump from state to state, local place to local place, and suck out as much tax money, as much subsidy, and as much land grants, and as much as they can get. Those aren't really companies that you really want. And they're not ones that are really creating jobs. They're the bottom feeders. And the sad thing is Boeing, to me, is an institution that, you know, I don't know that I want to see them become that bottom feeder, but it's looking more and more like, you know, they're following the corporate path. Now, according to the Center for Effective Government, their study pointed out that 30 Fortune 500 companies, the 30 that paid the highest tax rates from 2008 to 2010, and they go through in their report who they are. I'm not going to go through them, but they said the 30 companies that paid the highest tax rate. Because remember, the United States has the highest tax rate in the entire world, except nobody really pays it. But those companies that paid the highest rates, they created about 200,000 jobs during that time frame. So you've got, you know, these 30 companies paying higher taxes and creating jobs, high-paying jobs. Now, flip that around. Look at it from the other side. The 30 companies who paid the lowest tax rates, they actually fired over 51,000 people. In fact, the number that they came up with was 51,289 jobs gone. So, you know, I look at this and I go, okay, hold on, let me think this through. What we're told is if we give these companies boatloads of cash, if we give them the tax breaks, if we give them the loopholes, if we give them the free, the free land, the free power, the free, you know, all of the stuff, we give them free, you know, interest-free loans, you know, we give them the baby and the bathwater and all of it, they're going to create jobs. That's what they keep telling us. That's the mantra we keep hearing. That's the frame that my entire education life has been thrown at me. If you give them tax cuts, they'll create jobs. Like there's some magic formula that says tax cuts equal jobs. No, tax cuts equal somebody putting a whole boatload of money in their pocket. The only thing that creates jobs is demand. You know, we learned that. We know that. But it's not what we're told. So when I look at this report, it just solidifies what I've been saying for years on this program and what we all know is true. You have bottom feeders who are only looking out to, hey, how can I put more money in my pocket? So as they're fighting for the loopholes and they're pitting states against one another to compete to give who can have the most subsidies and the biggest award checks, they're the ones who are actually cutting jobs and slashing employment. And breaking that frame. The companies who are paying taxes saying, you know what, we're gonna sledding along, we're doing our business. We're actually created about 200,000 jobs. So it's kind of interesting to me how this works out, how what we're told and what's reality kind of completely upside down. It's kind of like what they talk about free trade. And look, we're going to hear more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. We're going to hear more about, oh, we need more free trade. Well, the number's out. This morning they came out with the trade figures for October. And overall, as a nation, we had a trade deficit of $40.6 billion for the month of October. That's down from $43 billion in September. But understand, it's going to go back up as we move into the holiday season. Our trade deficit with China was $28.9 billion in October, down from the all-time high of $30.5 billion. Our trade deficit with Japan jumped from $5.5 to $6.4 billion in October. Now, you look at our trade deficit with China. We are on pace to break last year's record. Last year, at this point, our year-to-date balance, $261.6 billion trade deficit. Today, we're $267 billion. So we're $5.4 billion up and over last year. And that's going to expand. So when I hear people going on about, Rick, we need to watch our budget deficits. I say, no, what we need to do, we need to watch our trade deficits. We need to start holding these companies accountable. And all of this it's pitting us against one another. This whole idea that, well, we need competition, yet there's no real competition going on. What this is just, hey, let's figure out how we can privatize our education and gut more money out of that, how we can screw up our infrastructure and take more money out of that, how we can pass legislation that makes, well, the very well-to-do even more so at the expense of everyone else. And I got to ask you, at what point do you say enough is enough? This Boeing deal, are you happy with it? Is this what we should be doing? Hey, are we creating jobs by going here's a pot of gold? I don't know. I'm against handing out money to these big companies. And at some point, Congress is going to have to step in and intervene and say, no more already. No more at all. Anyway, this week, ALEC is in Washington, D.C., the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're going to have their week of events, State and National Policy Summit. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the big summit this week, what the goals of the new year for ALEC are, what they've done, and what we need to know on how we fight back. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is appealing a judge's decision to allow Detroit to proceed with the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. If the bankruptcy goes ahead, city workers could see their average $19,000 a year pensions be cut as low as $9,000 a year. AFSCME says it's a very scary day for Detroit citizens, especially city retirees. On Tuesday, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled in favor of State Emergency Manager Kevin Orr that the bankruptcy can proceed. In his opinion, Judge Rhodes said that under Michigan's Constitution, pension rights for city workers are treated like any other contract rights in a bankruptcy. And since the state is authorizing the bankruptcy, the pension rights can be cut or abridged like any other contract in a bankruptcy. Protesters at the courthouse when the ruling was made said the case was about busting unions, privatizing workers, and wiping out pensions. Michigan Republicans used their state emergency manager law to put Kevin Orr in charge in Detroit, which led to the bankruptcy filing.
American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says this is a dark day for the people of Detroit. And she said if Detroit wants to rebuild a strong economy, it needs to prioritize its workers and middle class over the interests of Wall Street. Weingarten says $19,000 a year pensions didn't cause Detroit's bankruptcy. Skyrocketing financial costs and a shrinking tax base did. Newly exposed documents published by the Guardian newspaper reveal plans by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to shield itself against lobbying laws while pushing a centralized state-by-state corporate agenda. The documents also reveal that ALEC is planning to require state lawmakers who join the group pledge an oath of loyalty to ALEC above any duty to their constituents. The Guardian also says ALEC is facing a funding crisis and is trying to get more than 40 major donors to return to the funding fold. Companies like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, Kraft, McDonald's, and Walmart left ALEC in the midst of the furor over the Trayvon Martin killing. ALEC is a main backer of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, like the one George Zimmerman used to get away with killing Martin. In Washington Tuesday, Fasters in the Fast for Families announced an expansion of the action. Four fasters have gone 22 days of a water-only fast to highlight the moral dimensions of the failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The long-term fasters were given blessed bread as they gave the crosses they have worn for the last 22 days to new long-term fasters. Fast for Families is being supported by a big group of organizations, clergy, and political leaders as the fasters urge the U.S. House to act on immigration reform. To support Workers Independent News and keep workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Speaking of one of those tax shelters, I look at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Big meeting this week in Washington, D.C. They're there for the State and National Policy Summit. Basically, you know, giving the marching orders to our legislators to say, here's what corporate America wants from you. You know all those campaign dollars you took? Well, this is now what you've got to go home and do. And I think it's great that finally there are groups out there like ALEC Exposed and others who are saying, you know what, this is what they're doing and this is why it's toxic, which is why we've asked Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, to come talk to us about the big summit and what ALEC means not only to citizens but also to our children. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be with you, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this group who, you know, for years nobody knew who they were or what they did. But since the Trayvon Martin case, it's really come to people's attention just how toxic this organization has been.
Right. I mean, you know, this organization has been operating in the shadows for quite a while. And then what you saw in 2010 and probably before, but we started noticing it in 2010, is that these same folks who talked about state rights all the time and how every state is different, then just somewhat mysteriously, there's a bunch of model bills that pop up in lots of different states that look almost identical.
Yep.
That just, that go after voting rights, that go after women's rights, that go after economic rights, that go after Medicaid, that try to privatize schools. And, you know, when you know, I don't like to believe in conspiracies, but I think, you know, I thank the Guardian because they have just stripped the veil off of ALEC, and what you see is an entity that is attempting to do everything in its power to keep the power of the elite, not to fight for a middle class, not to fight to create shared prosperity, but to keep the status quo and the power for those who have it right now. So it's kind of the appendage of Citizens United as opposed to a shared prosperity and a middle class from, you know, from the middle out. And you just are seeing this from these documents. And, you know, and what ALEC is trying to do now is that they're desperately trying to get back many of the corporate sponsors they had who didn't much mind taking away economic rights or voting rights, but, you know, are clearly selling to the same groups of people that were so, so, so upset with the Trayvon Martin murder.
Yeah, and I look at this, and you know, as horrible as that was, I still look at the voter suppression as one of the worst things that they've done. All of the model legislation that they push in state after state to go after workers' rights, the destruction of collective bargaining, pension, all the pension stuff we're seeing. You know, at some point, you know, it's not a conspiracy. What is, you know, I look at Florida.
Exactly.
One of my key moments was in Florida, there was a legislator there. She actually turned in a piece of ALEC legislation with ALEC's name still on it.
So, and then what you also see is that in the Chicago meeting this summer, there was a push by ALEC to bind its members, particularly its leaders, but then also its members, to actually pursue the legislation that they're pushing as opposed to what the people need and want. So this, you know, these documents, you know, a lot of people are focused on how many of the companies have left. But what these documents point out is a pattern and practice to actually get rid of rights of the middle class and to actually undermine the rights of democracy that regular folks want and need to collectively organize to change things in America. And I think that it becomes, you know, it's really shining the spotlight on who ALEC is. It's not this neutral, charitable organization. It is a lobbying front for corporations, for the Koch brothers, and it should be seen as such.
But isn't it, you know, I go back to it, and I know most of my listeners, and I know a lot of people who have read the Powell memo. Isn't this really the extension of that Powell memo? It's really not about building a middle class. It's about stealing back all of the gains of the middle class. Because if you read Lewis Powell's memo for the Chamber of Commerce, it was how we break down unions. It was how we put people back in their place and consolidate power back into the hands of that day's robber barons who were kind of feeling bad. Because they didn't have the wealth of past generations. I don't know that it was ever meant to for the common good. I think it was more of how do we steal back all those hard-fought gains and give it back to the very top?
Well, I think what you're seeing here is that in a period of – there's two things that are converging at the same time, which is why ALEC and their model bills got so much ahead of steam. Number one, they tapped into – what is the legitimate anger of Americans that our lives are different than what we expected them to be.
Yep.
There is a notion in America, the great equalizer in America, is that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll be treated fairly, and your kids, the next generation, will be do better than our generation. And that's, in some ways, the thread that has bound us together. So they took that anger, which is legitimate anger, and they used it to actually keep the trickle-down economics that have caused this. It's kind of like, remember Tom Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yep.
You know, people in Kansas are great people, but they, you know, but somebody sold them a bill of goods that somebody else was doing well and they were not. But when you pull the veil off, because, you know, these folks have a lot of money, they know how to put talking points together.
Sure.
And, you know, and they would say anything they needed to say. But when you pull the veil off, what you see is that this is a group of people that is wholly concerned with keeping their own power, not with the creation or recreation of the middle class, but keeping their own power.
Let me ask
you
this.
And that's what these documents show. The democracy document was so revealing But so are all the other model bills about the loss of economic rights, the loss of voting rights, because they want to keep power where it is right now and trickle down economics, not in shared prosperity.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. But let me ask you this, because, you know, I look at the narrative that they've created, and you brought up what's the matter with Kansas, and you know, this frame that, you know, I'm not doing as well as I thought I would, or as well as, you know, the last generation did and all that. And the narrative was, well, you're not doing as well because of those people. What the right and the wealth class, I think, masterfully did is threw out some red meat and said, here's the common enemy. Here's the blame. Not how you're going to make your life better, how you're going to move forward, but gave someone something to blame. And I don't think the left or labor or any of the other folks really had a narrative ready to go yet. I think, you know, I think now we're starting to see it come around. And I think that narrative has to be there, like I've been talking about on this program. We're in the final throes of finishing a book from our labor history tour. And, you know, I was remembering growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland when I was a kid. And the neighbor family, the husband got a job at Ford, a good-paying union job at Ford. And right before my very eyes, you see their lives get better. And I finish it up by saying, and they had food at the end of the month. The narrative was a good-paying union job, food at the end of the month, opportunity, prosperity, new shoes for the kids, opportunity.
Right.
That's what I think we need to get back to.
Right. Well, I think there's three. So number one, Rick, one of the things we're doing, look, tomorrow, on December 5th, sorry, I'm walking through the streets of New York right now.
I hear you.
So on tomorrow, December 5th, the fast food workers are staging, you know, 100 strikes throughout the country.
Yep.
To really focus the community on the poverty wages that fast food workers are paid. And fast food workers are not kids going to college. Fast food workers are you know, middle-aged folks who need to work. Who need to work to feed their families and put a roof over their head. And then on Monday, December 9th, there are over 60 actions throughout the country, in 60 cities, of parent groups, clergy, other community groups, teachers, all together talking about reclaiming the promise of public education, fighting austerity, fighting privatization, fighting deprofessionalization, and fighting not only against things, but for a vision of great neighborhood public schools, of schools that are safe, of schools that parents want to send their kids to, educators want to work out, of where you have the joy of learning. So when we work together, when community is our new density, when we start thinking about how we have a collective responsibility to create opportunity in this country, that's when we'll turn the country around. That's when we'll create the new majority. And that's what the labor movement is trying to do now and what a lot of community groups are trying to do now. I'm very excited about Monday and about what we're doing to reclaim the promise of public education.
Yeah, I'm with you. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, and you look at here in Pennsylvania, they're pushing all of the charter schools and the whole this new privatization scheme. We've got a couple pieces of legislation that's going to take the concept of charter schools being laboratories of innovation, and just going to throw that out the window, because I don't know that was ever the goal from the ALEC point of view. When you look at this whole push towards privatization of education, what do you tell parents in areas that they've been told their schools are struggling? But here's one with new shiny doors. How do
right.
we fight that battle that I see raging in places like Philadelphia?
So one is, we talk about values before we talk about evidence. And at the end of the day, let me say three things about this. Number one, at the end of the day, parents are entitled to great choices for education for their kids. That is an American value, to have great public schools. And so some of us work really hard to make sure that we make our public schools the best they can be. Number two, those public schools have to be safe, and they have to be able to differentiate instruction to the needs of all kids and also meet all kids' needs. And so you can understand why, you know, a marketeer would market successfully a charter to a parent with a shiny roof, a shiny new door and saying that the school is safe. But the bottom line is this. Charters, particularly in Philadelphia, they do no better than public schools after, even after the public schools have been started, even after the public schools don't have guidance counselors or extracurricular activities. But the second thing is this. Even at their best, and charters don't do better in the main, but even at their best, even if they were worth that which the peddlers peddle, you create a class of winners and losers when we actually have to make sure that all kids are winners and all kids have opportunity. America is about all kids having the opportunity to dream their dreams and achieve them. Not some kids, but all kids. And that's what ultimately I think parents and community really want. They want to fix schools, not close them, and they want to have great neighborhood public schools as their primary choice.
I'm right there with you. I want the best for my kids, like I think anyone else does. And this whole grill and drill, teach for the test, high-stakes stuff, to me is, well, it's not doing my kids any good.
No, it's not. I mean, what we're seeing with those PISA results from the last, from yesterday, the international test results, is that, you know, poverty does really matter in this country. Half our kids in public schools are poor, but, you know, our issue is, what are we going to do about it? And what we've seen is that the last 10 years of this fixation on testing, hyper-testing every student, having sanctioning of teachers, and having closures of schools, it hasn't moved the needle when you look at us compared to the rest of the, you know, compared to countries in the rest of the world. Let's do the things that we know work, which is great neighborhood public schools, taking kids where they are, not where we want them to be, engaging them in the arts and in music and critical thinking and project-based learning. And let's bring the joy back to schools, but make sure we're helping all children.
I'm with you. President Weingarten, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you so much, Rick.
It was great talking. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Irony is dead. It has been garroted by reality. For proof, check out the Beverage Institute for Health and Wellness. Sounds like a spa in Arizona where you might enjoy a cleansing regimen of aloe vera smoothies, doesn't it? But no, it's a hokey science front owned and run by Coca-Cola. The world's largest beverage purveyor wants you to be assured that none of its sugary, empty calorie, or artificially sweetened concoctions are a cause of obesity. Hey, shouts Coke's instituters, three or more colas a day are simply a part of an integrated healthy diet for children and adults alike. There is no scientific evidence that connects sugary beverages to obesity, snapped a top Coke executive, adding that we don't believe in empty calories. Oh, well, then okay. But in the off chance that you might want a more independent scientific source, try the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, billed as the world's largest organization of food and nutrition professionals. But wait, while the AND is not owned by Coke, it does lease out its integrity to the cola giant. Coca-Cola is listed on the Academy's website as a generous sponsor and partner in its scientific work. In fact, the Academy certifies Coke's Beverage Institute as an official provider of, quote, continuing education for registered dietitians. How neat! A corporation that profiteers by peddling nutritionally worthless and health-endangering products, finances the academic outfit that's most responsible for educating Americans about healthy foods. And that academy, in turn, embraces the corporate fiction that sugary drinks pose no health problems. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's not irony. It's shameful corruption. The greatest obesity crisis in America is not the cola itself, but the fat-headed ethics of single-minded corporate profiteers and their apologists.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website for RickSmithShow.com, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Got a thought, question, comments, whatever's on your mind. Insurance Commissioner from the great state of Georgia, Ralph Hudgens. I just got to read what he said. And it's one of those things that makes you go, do you have your talking points straight? And I hear a lot of right-wingers who love to use talking points, but they don't really grasp the concept. He's talking about Obamacare and this whole idea that pre-existing conditions are, well, they shouldn't be insured because insurance companies, they can't afford it, and your rates are going to go up. But anyway, here's what he said at a meeting back in November at the CSRA Republican Women's Club in Evans, Georgia. He said, I've had several companies come in and they've said, just the fact that the individual market pre-existing conditions have to be covered on January 1st, that is going to double the cost of insurance. He says, and if you don't really understand what covering pre-existing conditions would be like, it would be like in Georgia. We have a law that says you have to have automobile insurance. If you have liability insurance, you're going to drive on Georgia roads, you have to have liability insurance. You don't have to have collision. You don't have to have comprehensive. You have to have liability. Well, it's like saying, if you're going along, you have a wreck, and it's your fault. Well, pre-existing condition, we'd call up your insurance agent and say, I'd like to get me some collision insurance for my car. And your agent says, well, you've never had that before. Why you want now? And you say, well, I just wrecked my car, and it's my fault, and I want the insurance company to pay for the repair of my car. That's exactly the same thing as pre-existing insurance. First, let me, the whole insurance, car insurance thing, the whole personal responsibility thing, aren't these the same people who said that we shouldn't have an individual mandate like we have with car insurance? I mean, I'm just saying, at some point, had we had the personal responsibility thing going on and people had, you know, health care all along, you know, just saying. But the pre-existing condition thing is very interesting to me because he will have you believe that, you know, that cancer, you just got it. You know, it was your fault you got cancer. And now you want someone to pay for it. No, what this law is doing, and look, they're taking a sliver of this. What this law is doing is saying everyone has to have insurance. Everyone has to be responsible. Which, you know, I thought Republicans, conservatives, I thought they believed in personal responsibility. I hear them say it a lot. I don't really know that they believe it. But you do hear them complain, whine, and, you know, and pitch a you-know-what. By the prospect of having to insure themselves, which I just find very interesting. Now, understand where this is coming from. The insurance companies don't want to cover pre-existing conditions. You look at over 20% of those who applied for insurance in the before Obamacare individual market, they were denied coverage. Over 20%. So you say, well, you know, I had cancer. They were denied coverage. Or the other part of this is they jacked the rate up so high that you couldn't get it. which is why you had so many bankruptcies, which is why you had so many problems here. Now, I'm of the mindset, look, we cover everybody. And everybody pays into the system. And it should be one big system so that we pool the risk. Because that's what insurance is. At the base of it, insurance really is socialism. Because we're saying what we're going to do is we're going to mitigate risk by having everybody in this big pool. And we know that we hope there'll be more people paying in who aren't sick than are, and the system will work. Now, understand, I've met so many people over the last couple of years since this law has been in place who were able to get insurance through the high-risk pool, who were able to say, you know, I had this pre-existing condition that no insurance company would cover me with. I can now get coverage. And the question that I would ask, now understand, the good insurance commissioner took, you know, about $150,000 from the insurance industry to run his campaign in 2010, and the governor of the state took a whole boatload of cash from the insurance industry, United Healthcare and WellCare of Georgia, big checks. But I look at this and I go, isn't the larger question, especially when you look at the notch of the Bible Belt that is Georgia, and you say, you know, what about caring for the sick? Did I miss something? Because in my country, in the country that I love, no one should go without being able to see a doctor if they're sick. No one should have to go without care just because an insurance company said, sorry, you're a high risk. We're not going to make money off of you. That's the reality in this. You've got these insurance companies because, look, Obamacare is now the law. And you've got a majority of the people now saying, well, we should move forward with it, implement it, and we'll fix what needs to be fixed. Repealing it, there are a small number of people who are saying repeal it now. Most of them, you know, whack job Tea Party people who are left in the club after everybody else took off. And what you've got is you've got all these Republicans who are going, well, what do we do now? The healthcare.gov website seems to be working. On Tuesday, the administration announced that almost 1.5 million people had been approved for Medicaid coverage. Hundreds of thousands of people were signing up through the federal and state, you know, exchanges. You know, things are seeming to work. They seem to have worked out some of the bugs. There are more, but, you know, there's some problems. So what are they going to do? Well, you can't give up the attack, can you? No. What they did is we're back to the $716 billion from Medicare. The Republicans have gone back to that canard that we all know is wrong. But, you know, it's about scaring people, isn't it? And if that isn't bad enough, and this is what just has me kind of flipped. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on Tuesday. One of those things where I go, really? We don't have anything better to do? There are no pressing needs. There's a budget that doesn't need to be passed, or we're going to have another shutdown in January. Don't we have something to do? Well, the House Judiciary Committee held their hearing on Tuesday to consider, quote, the presidential constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws. Dana Milbank over at the Washington Post, he reported that the unanimous view among Republicans was that President Obama had not done his duty. In fact, the main item on the menu appeared to be impeachment. Here we are again. And look, it's not the first time they've brought up the I word. At least 13 of the 22 Republicans on the committee have threatened or hinted at impeaching Obama. This is not new. You got people like Steve King, who said, you know, the word that we don't like to say in this committee, and I'm not about to utter it here in this particular hearing. But everyone knows what he meant. And in fact, Doug Collins, the Republican from Georgia, said, I'm off and ask this. You got to go up there and you got to just impeach him. Blake Fahrenthold, Texas Republican, said, who said there are enough votes in the House to impeach. He said, we've also talked about the I word, impeachment, which I don't think would get past the Senate in the current climate. Is there anything else we can do? Trent Franks said Obama's actions could be considered royal prerogatives, which is, in my if my history is right, what we had is this little unpleasantness with about Great Britain. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where he's going with there either. Maybe I don't, because taxes are lower than they've been in years. But since they have nothing else, it's time to make stuff up. It's time to change the subject. And I guess the question I have is, are we going to fall for it again? This is what they did the last time they had nothing. You go back to Bill Clinton. I didn't think he was all that great a president first term. They went after him with all guns barreled and made people sympathetic towards him. And here, and spent years and millions and millions and millions of dollars on a witch hunt. I mean, you go back to Whitewater, Jennifer Flowers, the Ron Brown, the Vince Foster. You go back through all of these conspiracies and all of this insanity, and you go, what did we accomplish? You know what we accomplished? We accomplished looking the other way when 9/11 happened. We accomplished allowing a growing economy, a booming economy, to fade and sag. And allow a dim-witted president like Bush to come in and give away a generation of surplus and put us back into deep, deep debt. Yeah, that's what we allowed. Was it worth it? And here we are again, right back, history repeating itself. You've got these dindle nuts in there going, oh, hey, let's impeach him. Do your job. That simple. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt bill threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13, did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm on a Mexican radio.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Under the heading of running government like a business, I look at what's going on in Detroit, where they basically just run through bankruptcy, cut off all of those pensioners and all those legacy costs. Yeah, run it like a business. Yeah. Look here in Pennsylvania, there's a workers' comp bill that's working its way through. That I find, you know, another one of those moments where you go, you know, this is, again, business-friendly run amok. This is another opportunity for business to weasel its way out. There's this fund, this uninsured employer guarantee fund in the workers' comp system. It says if you're an employer and you don't have workers' comp insurance, for one reason or another, it's not your employee's fault that you don't have insurance. It's not their fault that the company basically broke the law and didn't cover their workers' comp. So there's a fund that says, okay, we're going to fund that. We're going to make sure that if you're injured and your employer didn't have it, we're going to make sure that you get covered, that you get the health care, you get the treatment you need, and you get I think it's 66 1/3% of your wages. What they're talking about now is since they've underfunded it so badly, and they haven't fixed the funding formula, what they're saying is what we want to do now is, and there's a whole lot more to this, but this is the simplistic version. We want to give the Secretary of the Department of Labor the power to unilaterally cut benefits that are being paid now or in the past. So, you know, so let's say we got $1 million. We run out of $1 million in June. Sorry, no more fund for the rest of the year. And, oh, we'll cut from people who were paying. Which, you know, I go back to my belief that here we are, that grand compact between citizens and their government, between labor and the employers, this grand compact called workers' compensation, again, broken. The grand bargain seems to be broken, this great compromise broken. And I've been saying for years, give me back my constitutional rights. Give me my constitutional right to sue, because evidently the ALEC-type legislation that keeps going through, all of these corporate attacks on workers' rights, and the safety net for working people just being tattered and destroyed. And it's this idea of business friendly. It's this idea of we need to run government like a business. And we need to protect the bad actors. And I look at Blanche Lincoln, who was a bad Democrat from the get-go. But now that she's out of the Senate, she's working with this group, itsmybusiness.com, which, again, you know, you kind of got to love the messaging that goes along with this. What their goal is, they want to protect the independent contractor. So all of those folks who are misclassified, all of those folks who are working for companies, you know, under their work rules, wearing their uniform, driving a truck with the company name on the side, we all know who I'm talking about. They're protected. Because you've got bad Democrats like Blanche Lincoln and the other corporatists who keep pushing, it's my business. Let me be exploited if I want to be. And I find it interesting that she's the chairman of this big coalition that champions small businesses, because she says it's the backbone of our economy, which I love how they exploit small business, you know, like FedEx. I sit and I look at this and I go, you know, how much of this more will we take? How much more will we take from bad Democrats and really horrible Republicans? And here on the state level, I mean, the assaults have come often. The ALEC legislation, all of this. You know, I look at our transportation bill. They got a $2 billion transportation bill, but the pound of flesh that they extracted from workers is lower wages for construction workers because they went after prevailing wage. And this is the first attack. This is the first in a long line to come of more attacks on prevailing wage. First, it was the unemployment bill that basically carved out construction workers and screwed them. And now this. I've yet to see anything that says, you know, the very well-to-do, the 1%, these big corporate special interests, maybe the Delaware loophole, maybe we should start looking at that. Maybe we should start looking at getting the people who are benefiting so wildly to get them to pay some of the freight. It's just a thought. It might work. I don't know. Hasn't been tried in my lifetime. It just might. But I look at the situation that we've been put in. And I don't believe any of this was by accident. All of this stuff, very well planned out. And this whole starve the beast deliberately to go after and privatize everything that we have. The things that we, the people, have built for ourselves, whether it's the wine and spirit shops or our transportation. It's all about who's going to benefit, who can pocket the most, our education. Talked with AFT President Randy Weingarten a moment ago. And, you know, you look what they're doing to education. All in the name of profit. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all email personally. Enjoy the contact. I'm curious what your thoughts on the whole privatization scheme. When we come back, I'm going to talk with the good folks at In the Public Interest about their new report that highlights some of the real just horror stories of privatization and profitization of our commons across the nation. Quick break, right back with Hour 2. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is appealing a judge's decision to allow Detroit to proceed with the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. If the bankruptcy goes ahead, city workers could see their average $19,000 a year pensions be cut as low as $9,000 a year. AFSCME says it's a very scary day for Detroit citizens, especially city retirees. On Tuesday, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled in favor of State Emergency Manager Kevin Orr that the bankruptcy can proceed. In his opinion, Judge Rhodes said that under Michigan's Constitution, pension rights for city workers are treated like any other contract rights in a bankruptcy. And since the state is authorizing the bankruptcy, the pension rights can be cut or abridged like any other contract in a bankruptcy. Protesters at the courthouse when the ruling was made said the case was about busting unions, privatizing workers, and wiping out pensions. Michigan Republicans used their state emergency manager law to put Kevin Orr in charge in Detroit, which led to the bankruptcy filing. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says this is a dark day for the people of Detroit And she said if Detroit wants to rebuild a strong economy, it needs to prioritize its workers and middle class over the interests of Wall Street. Weingarten says $19,000 a year pensions didn't cause Detroit's bankruptcy. Skyrocketing financial costs and a shrinking tax base did. Newly exposed documents published by the Guardian newspaper reveal plans by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to shield itself against lobbying laws while pushing a centralized state-by-state corporate agenda. The documents also reveal that ALEC is planning to require state lawmakers who join the group pledge an oath of loyalty to ALEC above any duty to their constituents. The Guardian also says ALEC is facing a funding crisis and is trying to get more than 40 major donors to return to the funding fold. Companies like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, Kraft, McDonald's, and Walmart left ALEC in the midst of the furor over the Trayvon Martin killing. ALEC is a main backer of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, like the one George Zimmerman used to get away with killing Martin. In Washington Tuesday, Fasters in the Fast for Families announced an expansion of the action. Four fasters have gone 22 days of a water-only fast to highlight the moral dimensions of a failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The long-term fasters were given blessed bread as they gave the crosses they have worn for the last 22 days to new long-term fasters. Fast for Families is being supported by a big group of organizations, clergy, and political leaders as the fasters urge the U.S. House to act on immigration reform. To support Workers Independent News and keep workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Oh yeah, what can we hock off next? What can we sell next? I mean, our education system, our roads, our bridges. What can we sell off? I mean, when I was a kid, the hospitals were community hospitals. They were owned by we the people. When I was a kid, public transportation, public education, those were viable, funded, important portions of our society. And what we've seen the profiteers say, hey, you know, we can make money off of that. We want it. And we'll give you a couple of pennies. You look at the wine and spirit shops here in Pennsylvania, how badly the profiteers want that. Question is it good for our... Is it good for our society? Is it good for the nation? Is it good for taxpayers? Well, the good folks at In the Public Interest today unveiled a new report titled Out of Control, the Coast-to-Coast Failures of Outsourcing Public Services to For-Profit Corporations. It highlights the horror stories of privatization across the country. I've got Blaine Rummel. He's the chief strategist at In the Public Interest to come talk to us about what's going on across the country. Blaine, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to be back with you.
You know, so I look at this study that you guys have come out with, and for listeners of this program, you know, we talk about this stuff all the time, but it's good to see that it's all in one place. Tell us, walk us through some of these outrageous horror stories of, because we're told quite often, private sector better, public sector bad.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be the default mentality these days, and what this report shows and what a couple other reports have shown that we've put out is that simply is not true. I think what we at In the Public Interest have been doing over the past few months is developing a legislative agenda, telling, you know, and doing cost analysis of what happens when we outsource public services. And what seemed to get lost in the mix was the actual stories, the human toll of what happens when these schemes and deals go wrong. And so the purpose of this report was to put together 26 stories, and believe me, there were a lot more. We actually had to spend more time trying to figure out which stories didn't go in the report than did on what happens. And we looked at stories that involved a violation of transparency, accountability, how people's wages were cut, and what we found was just remarkable. For example, let me give you a couple. In Indiana, in a few years ago, Governor Mitch Daniels had privatized Medicaid eligibility and food stamp eligibility, outsourced it to IBM. Thousands of low-income Hoosiers were wrongly dumped from those benefits, including a nun who was suffering from cancer, who had missed eligibility requirement because she was in the hospital being treated in Los Angeles County. Los Angeles County had contracted with a third party for foster care placement, and even though there had been repeated instances and reports of abuse, including locking children in a closet, this organization was able to have their contract automatically renewed year after year. We on the call today, we did a press call where we announced this this report, and we were lucky enough to be joined by John Liu, who is the comptroller of New York City. He talked about the CityTime scandal from a couple of years ago, where a company was brought in by the Bloomberg administration to take over tracking of time of city workers. And it ended up, it was supposed to cost $63 million. 12 years on, it ended up costing $700 million. Wow. 1,000% cost overrun.
Wow.
And it ended up in that particular case that John Liu came in, audited it, and people went to jail because of that one. So those are just some of the few stories that we cover in the report.
You know, I look at this, and again, I've been on the air now over 8 years here doing this program, and I ask often, is there anything that we've privatized, we've profitized, that has done better, better service, better cost, better for, you know, the people who are benefiting from it, anything other than better for the profiteers and the moneyed interests who profit from this? And I've yet to have that call of saying, yeah, I know something. So as you're looking through these reports, I'll ask you, is there anything that we've privatized that we've said, you know what, this would be better served being done in the hands of these private for-profit corporations? Can you find anything?
You know, I can't name anything right now. Just, you know, looking through and pouring through the past few years of studies. We had Dr. Janice Fine, who's a professor of employment relations at Rutgers University, who's an expert on outsourcing and privatization, and quoting her almost directly when she said today, you know, we hear this. We hear that the government is, you know, should be run like a business, that things will be done better, faster, and cheaper. She said, as somebody who has studied this closely for years, I can tell you, without fail, it almost never happens that way. And what ends up happening, unfortunately, is taxpayers lose control of their services, and can't hold these folks accountable. And these contracts are signed for sometimes decades at a time. One story in the report talks about Virginia, which has outsourced operation of a toll road, high occupancy toll road, carpooling lane, HOV lane, to an Australian-based company. It's a contract that lasts 40 years. There are clauses in the contract that actually punish taxpayers if there are too many carpoolers that use the carpooling lane, because that adversely affects the amount of money that they can collect in tolls. These ridiculous, these clauses where, you know, these companies say that, you know, we should bring free enterprise into the picture, we should bring competition, and they write clauses into the contracts that guarantee them profits.
Yeah, well, who's against guaranteed profits? I mean, I look at this, and, you know, you talk about all of these schemes. I mean, we keep hearing about public-private partnerships and how wonderful it is. Oh, we can do public things with private money. And I look at all the roads that are being built with private money. I'm not. Unless they're toll roads that have clauses like you're talking about. Look at healthcare.gov as another failed public-private partnership. 55 private for-profit corporations had their hands in that pie, and look what it got us.
Absolutely. That is one of the greatest misnomers about all this with the healthcare.gov. I see people asking, well, doesn't this mean government can't do big things anymore? Absolutely not. The healthcare.gov, to the extent that it was a failure, it was a failure of privatization. You said 55 contractors were responsible for putting that together, and they failed miserably. They wanted a piece of the $500 million pie. There was not adequate oversight there was not adequate oversight staffing. And so, of course, if you have 55 contractors that are more interested in making a profit than looking out for the public interest, public health, that's what you're going to get.
So now I want to swing this back around to the people who keep telling us we need to drag government into the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub. We need to make it so small. To me, healthcare.gov should be that clarion call moment where we go, there's been a massive brain drain. Look, honestly, I'll be the first to admit, our government right now couldn't do that website. The technical ability, the people to do it aren't there because they've been all starved out of this. So at some point, don't we have to ask the question, shouldn't we be getting the best qualified, best trained people to work for our government? At some point, don't we have to ask that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for the part of in the public interest, what we have done is we have developed a legislative agenda to prevent these horror stories from happening in other communities. And we call it the Taxpayer Empowerment Agenda, and it's available at our website, which is inthepublicinterest.org. And actually, if your listeners really want the latest from us, friend us on Facebook, find us on Facebook at In the Public Interest. The Taxpayer Empowerment Agenda is 11 proposals, and it does some of the things that you're talking about. It says that if you're a private company and you take over a service, you have got to post online all of your meetings and all of your decisions and your books, just like government does. It says there must be adequate staffing of the best and the brightest to make sure that these contracts don't go awry. It says that if the contracts do go awry, there's going to be language in the contract to make it easy to cancel the contract. And something important for your listeners, one of the most popular proposals is that if you're a private company and you take over a service, you have got to pay your workers a living wage and reasonable benefits. That plank in particular.
Wouldn't that kill it all? Yeah. I mean, wouldn't that kill all the whole privatization move? Because the only way these companies are going to be able to make any money is if they can screw their workers out of their wages and their pensions and their benefits.
Well, that's the thing. You know, the companies tell us that they're going to save all kinds of money through efficiency. And so what we're saying is, okay, prove it. Now, and for taxpayers, the important thing is when companies do come in, if they do cut wages and benefits, yes, you're absolutely right. That is the meatiest part, and they're able to show some savings. Our argument, though, is that what happens when you cut people's wages and benefits and pensions? And one of the stories in the report looks at food service workers in schools, K-12 schools in New Jersey, that were studied in 2009. Sodexo, Aramark, some of the big private food service companies came in and privatized those food service workers, cut their wages $4 to $6 an hour. What the study found was that many of these folks lost their health insurance as well, and had to go on to New Jersey Family Care, which is public assistance. And so what you have to ask yourself as a taxpayer, and what we're looking to promote here, is it may look like you're saving a few dollars and cents on the ledger on actual food service, but you're spending so much more when it comes to public assistance for folks who are now at or below the poverty line. And so privatization or outsourcing really doesn't save you any money at all.
That doesn't save society any money, and you're right. But, you know, what we do is we carve out winners and losers, the winners being those folks generally on Wall Street or who head up these big corporations, and the losers, well, that's the rest of us.
Absolutely. And that, in that case, you know, I keep going back to the report, but there's a story about that, the Chicago parking meter story. Chicago privatized its parking meters in 2009, signed a 75-year contract. They sold the rights to the parking meters for 75 years for $1.2 billion. It's estimated that by the time the contract ends, 70-some years from now, that drivers in Chicago will have paid $11 billion to a corporate consortium backed by Morgan Stanley on Wall Street. So this is it's ridiculous. We call them horror stories. It's outrageous what's happening. And we are working with lawmakers across the country to actually push a legislative agenda to prevent it from happening.
Well, let me ask you this, Blaine, because, you know, I keep going back to we need to have this conversation. You know, when Governor Corbett and Mike Terzai here in the state of Pennsylvania said we're going to privatize the state wine and spirit shops, this entity that we taxpayers here in Pennsylvania have a vested interest in. Pays $500 billion a year in revenue into the state coffers, does a whole lot of really great things, you know, make sure that alcohol is in the hands of people who should have it and, you know, or are legally able to have it without a whole enforcement mechanism and all that stuff. But they told us we're going to get $2 billion for it. And people were like, wow, $2 billion, yeah. And that's all they heard. But as right. the story went down, well, it's $1.5 billion, it's $1 billion, it's $500 million. Oh, it's no longer about the money. It's about core government functions. And I could keep going, but what about the $2 billion sale? We were told this. How does it keep changing? And then it comes down to me, it's just ideology. It's that there are folks in this country who believe that nothing should be in the hands of we the people. Everything needs to be in the hands of people who are going to, someone who's going to profit from it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It really does come down to ideology. And for so long that ideology has been, you know, yes, everything that's not nailed down should be privatized and sold off. And the reason for that is because, as you said at the top of the hour, government should run like a business because businesses can do things better, faster, and cheaper. For too long, those of us who believe in the public sector have put out the fact sheets and said that's not true, and here's why, and here's the numbers to prove it. What I think we've learned over the past couple of few decades is that's simply not enough. If that's what our response is going to be, then we're forever going to be on defense.
Right.
What we in the public interest are interested in doing is to really reframe this debate about one of control and asking taxpayers, do you want to lose control of your services, your schools, your roads, your bridges, to these for-profit corporations? And that really is at the heart of our legislative agenda. It's really keeping control control of services in taxpayers' hands.
Yeah.
And when you talk about it in that language, what you will see is folks from all political stripes, folks who identify themselves as strong Tea Party supporters, hate crony capitalism as much as the strongest progressive does. And so there actually is a good deal of common ground when it comes to outsourcing and privatization when we're talking about how taxpayers lose control.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is we've seen the movie. And the ending's always the same. Because, you know, here in Harrisburg, they're talking about, privatizing the parking garages and all of that. And all you gotta do is look to Chicago or to Pittsburgh or to other places that have done it. And you realize, you know, the rates are gonna go through the roof. And the money that you brought in is never going to be enough. So if the rates are gonna go up, why don't we just say, okay, we're gonna raise the rates and we the people will keep the money?
Right.
That seems logical to me.
Right. It does. I agree. When these corporations take over parking meters, for example, yeah, they do raise the rates. I'll use Chicago again. Chicago is now among the most expensive cities in the nation to park in. And not only is it more expensive, but they expanded paid parking to 7 days a week, and then they rolled back when there was an outcry about that. But now you pay for parking until 10 p.m. And not only that, but whenever a parking space is used for something like a parade or a community festival, taxpayers have to reimburse Morgan Stanley,
nice.
The Wall Street Bank,
nice.
For the use of that space during the time that it's used for a parade or community festival. That is just outrageous. That is a community where taxpayers' hands are completely tied, where democracy has essentially been taken away, because these folks, lawmakers, the public can't make decisions about parking policy because they're tied up in this contract for 75 years. The money's no longer being invested in the community. They no longer have control over what they can do in their own streets. That's absurd.
Yeah, I want to finish up on that point because I think that's so important. Because you know you look at and as I understand the Pittsburgh contract. Says that they can't increase public transportation into the city or the parking people have the ability to sue them because, hey, you're taking away potential parkers. Or, you know, like in Denver, evidently they can't build new roads because it may affect the toll operators, this ability, this tying our hands for the future. I mean, if we wanted to put high-speed rail in, sorry, can't do it. It just seems to me to be very short-sighted for such a short, small amount of money. It just seems to be a bad idea.
It definitely is, and I would, you know, I'll leave you on a positive note though, because we do see some instances, and these are included in the report as well, the opposite of horror stories, where communities have realized the error of giving control over to corporations and instead of insource them back to public control. The report includes a story from Hernando County, Florida, where in 2010 the jail was run by the private corporation, Corrections Corporation of America, and the corrections officers were way underpaid. Violence was a huge problem in the prison. The county sheriff walked away and said, enough is enough. I'm bringing control back to the public. Not only did he give the corrections officers a $7,000 increase when they became public employees again, which was in line with what other public service workers were making, but violence decreased in the prison, and the prison actually saved $1 million in the first year that it was back under public control. So this idea that public service workers, that the government can't do things efficiently is absolutely wrong. And stories like Hernando County, Florida, it's the same in Minnesota and a number of other states. If folks read the report, it's all right there.
And we'll make sure we get the link to the report at the website, therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Blaine Rummel's name. It'll take you right there. Blaine, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the time. We hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
You as well, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Again, the website, inthepublicinterest.org. Like I said, we've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Irony is dead. It has been garroted by reality. For proof, check out the Beveridge Institute for Health and Wellness. Sounds like a spa in Arizona where you might enjoy a cleansing regimen of aloe vera smoothies, doesn't it? But no, it's a hokey science front owned and run by Coca-Cola. The world's largest beverage purveyor wants you to be assured that none of its sugary, empty-calorie, or artificially sweetened concoctions are a cause of obesity. Hey, shouts Coke's Instituters, three or more colas a day are simply a part of an integrated, healthy diet for children and adults alike. There is no scientific evidence that connects sugary beverages to obesity, snapped a top Coke executive, adding that we don't believe in empty calories. Oh, well then, okay. But in the off chance that you might want a more independent scientific source, try the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, billed as the world's largest organization of food and nutrition professionals. But wait, while the AND is not owned by Coke, it does lease out its integrity to the cola giant. Coca-Cola is listed on the Academy's website as a generous sponsor and partner in its scientific work. In fact, the Academy certifies Coke's Beverage Institute as an official provider of, quote, continuing education for registered dietitians. How neat! A corporation that profiteers by peddling nutritionally worthless and health-endangering products finances the academic outfit that's most responsible for educating Americans about healthy foods, and that academy, in turn, embraces the corporate fiction that sugary drinks pose no health problems. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's not irony. It's shameful corruption. The greatest obesity crisis in America is not the cola itself, but the fat-headed ethics of single-minded corporate profiteers and their apologists.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, Visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, I look at this, and this report, you know, just kind of highlights some of the stories that, you know, we've talked about on this program for years. And to me, really highlights what I've been saying for years. You've yet to find me anything that we've privatized that's actually done what it was supposed to. And, because, look, I think Blaine hit on a very important issue, which is this idea of local control, this idea of surrendering our control. And you look at our trade policies as a nation, we've surrendered our ability to dictate what happens within our country with some of these trade policies. This idea of least restrictive trade barrier, where as a nation we can't enact laws that are going to benefit workers here. We can't enact laws that are going to protect consumers here. No, because we're opening ourselves up to be sued in secret courts, tribunals, not even American courts. But I look at this, and you know, it's well worth the read. The study called "Out of Control: The Coast-to-Coast Failures of Outsourcing Public Services to For-Profit Corporations," and you know, you look at some of this, like you talked about in Los Angeles, where they had given a $3 million contract to this Wings of Refuge to put kids in foster homes, even though, as he pointed out, kids were beaten, they were locked away, they ran a horrible service, yet they had a contract. And they had the lobbyists who were able to grease some palms because, you know, we've had this belief, you know, hey, you know, Rick, it's a good thing. It's a good thing to privatize. It's a good thing to make sure that the profiteers are well healed and well taken care of. But at the end of it, you know, why are we locking ourselves into long-term contracts and say, you know what, in the future you can't do any of these things. You're saddled with what you have right now. And as we sell, as states have sold off roads, as cities have sold off parking authorities and all of this stuff, what has it gotten us? Well, all those contracts come with clauses. I mean, think about it. You know, Harrisburg's talking about privatizing the parking garages and the parking authority and the meters and all of that. Does that mean I'm never going to get Corridor 1 from Carlisle to Harrisburg? Does that mean that there's never going to be public transportation into the state capital beyond what we have right now? There's going to be no light rail. There's going to be no more bus service. Is that what it means? Well, if we decide that we want that as a society, we're going to have to pay for it. And not just the building of it and the maintenance of the service, but pay for the parking that, sorry, we now bought because we signed something years and years and years ago. I mean, all of this privatization to me is just really wrong-headed, and we've become a very tip-of-the-nose society. The here and now. Oh, we got a couple dollars. I mean, the Wine and Spirit Shop is a perfect example of this. They told us $2 billion. $2 billion, it'll fill our budget hole. One fell swoop, be painless. I remember, oh, it'll be painless. We'll sell it off. It'll fill our budget. We won't have to raise taxes. Everything will be wonderful. We won't cut anything. Oh, it'll be great. Then you go, well, how'd you come up with $2 billion? Well, did you reach around behind and dig real deep and pop out a number? Well, yeah. Because then they went down to, like, it was 1.7, then it was 1.5, then it was 1, then it was 500 million. And then it was, oh, well, it's not about the money anymore because we don't really need it because we gutted at public education. We kicked those poor people off of adult basic. Those vulnerable people who had drug and alcohol problems who were on their last possible chance to do anything, the most vulnerable in society, well, we kicked them off too, off the general assistance budget. So we didn't really need the money. It's core function of government. It's ridiculous. It's a ripoff. And the sad thing is we keep falling for it. Because we've been sold this BS, private is better, public is bad. I'm telling you right now, it's backwards. What we the people want, we the people should do, and we the people should hold on to it. That simple. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
To The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is appealing a judge's decision to allow Detroit to proceed with the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. If the bankruptcy goes ahead, city workers could see their average $19,000 a year pensions be cut as low as $9,000 a year. AFSCME says it's a very scary day for Detroit citizens, especially city retirees. On Tuesday, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled in favor of state emergency manager Kevin Orr that the bankruptcy can proceed. In his opinion, Judge Rhodes said that under Michigan's Constitution, pension rights for city workers are treated like any other contract rights in a bankruptcy. And since the state is authorizing the bankruptcy, the pension rights can be cut or abridged like any other contract in a bankruptcy. Protesters at the courthouse when the ruling was made said the case was about busting unions, privatizing workers, and wiping out pensions. Michigan Republicans used their state emergency manager law to put Kevin Orr in charge in Detroit, which led to the bankruptcy filing. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says this is a dark day for the people of Detroit, and she said if Detroit wants to rebuild a strong economy, it needs to prioritize its workers and middle class over the interests of Wall Street. Weingarten says $19,000 a year pensions didn't cause Detroit's bankruptcy. Skyrocketing financial costs and a shrinking tax base did. Newly exposed documents published by the Guardian newspaper reveal plans by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to shield itself against lobbying laws while pushing a centralized state-by-state corporate agenda. The documents also reveal that ALEC is planning to require state lawmakers who join the group pledge an oath of loyalty to ALEC above any duty to their constituents. The Guardian also says ALEC is facing a funding crisis and is trying to get more than 40 major donors to return to the funding fold. Companies like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, Kraft, McDonald's, and Walmart left ALEC in the midst of the furor over the Trayvon Martin killing. ALEC is a main backer of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, like the one George Zimmerman used to get away with killing Martin. In Washington Tuesday, Fasters in the Fast for Families announced an expansion of the action. Four fasters have gone 22 days of a water-only fast to highlight the moral dimensions of a failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The long-term fasters were given blessed bread as they gave the crosses they have worn for the last 22 days to new long-term fasters. Fast for Families is being supported by a big group of organizations, clergy, and political leaders, as the fasters urged the U.S. House to act on immigration reform. To support Workers Independent News and keep workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day, donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Doesn't it sound like he's trying to convince himself? Every time Brett plays that, it makes me think, the guy's trying to convince himself, yes, I am, even though I'm hopefully going to lose. Bought the house in South Carolina, and good for him. Hope he got a good deal on it. Anyway, last couple of days we've been talking about, you know, the Walmarts and the big box retailers, how they are tracking our movements, our purchases. All this data is being collected. All of this information about us is being collected. Cameras everywhere. Well, now I see a piece of legislation in the Senate here in Pennsylvania that's going to allow policemen to wear body-mounted cameras. And, you know, the first one I saw this, I asked myself, well, can I have cameras to record them? I don't think so. I don't know that I'm thrilled with this, which is why we've asked Andy Hoover, legislative director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, to come talk to us about Senate Bill 1168, which is an amendment to the Wiretap Act. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to talk with you.
So is this a good thing? This is a bad thing? I don't know that I'm thrilled with the idea of being recorded every minute of my life.
Well, that's a fair point. This could be a good thing, but the way it's written right now, it's a bad thing. Let me explain that. First of all, to answer your first comment, you can record the police as a citizen, and if they try to stop you, call the ACLU, because we have had numerous cases in which citizens have been arrested for recording police officers with cameras, and the courts have upheld a citizen's right to do that. But on the police side, so here's the situation. I say it could be a good thing because if it's done right, it does provide a level of accountability for everyone involved, including the police officer, him or herself, instead of things breaking down to a he said situation. But the way this bill is written, there are really very few boundaries on the officers. There are a few. They cannot record in a private residence. They have to announce to people in the vicinity that they are recording, but that's pretty much it. Perhaps the most critical piece that's missing from our perspective is that there's no requirement that the cameras are in constant use when they're encountering the public. Now, that's an issue because that means they can selectively turn the cameras on and off when it's convenient.
Yeah, I mean, that selective editing is always of concern. But, you know, to me, I got to be honest, and maybe it's just because I'm not a big technology guy, and maybe I'm just I have this fear of all of everywhere you look, there are cameras. Everywhere you look, they're collecting data and information, and you wonder how much control do I have as an individual? Do people have as individuals to control what of them is being taken?
Right, and that's part of the multiple layers here with this issue. I mean, there's a fair amount of nuance to this issue. Of course, as soon as you walk out the door of your house or your office building or wherever you may be, as soon as you're out in the street, you obviously lose a certain level of privacy. But Pennsylvania law does have a very strong protection for people in their conversations. We have what's known as two-party consent, or you could call it all-party consent, meaning that if there's an expectation of privacy in a conversation, then the audio recording of that conversation requires consent from everybody involved. So let's say after your show tonight, you and Brett are sitting there in the studio just chatting. There's no one else around. You know, there's no custodian nearby cleaning up who can overhear you. It's just you two. You would both have to consent to being recorded by the other. If someone could overhear that conversation, then you would not have an expectation of privacy and you could just record. So that's what they're amending here. They are amending that part of the Wiretap Act to give police an exception for using these cameras. So
I guess I'm not entirely opposed to them being able to record in situations in their official capacity.
Right. Well, that's right, and that's our argument on the citizen side, that when police officers are engaged in their duties for the sake of government accountability, citizens should have the right to record them. Now, the data retention is another layer of this whole issue. There's nothing in the bill that speaks to how long the video is retained. And anytime the government is collecting information about our personal whereabouts, we advocate for data destruction at some point. Otherwise, you have a situation where government can start connecting dots and they know where you are at certain times.
Or all the time.
I mean, right.
Especially as we're carrying around these little GPS things with us everywhere we go.
Exactly.
I was just talking to someone the other day They were saying that, you know, that Walmart now collects all this amazing amount of data. And, you know, when you walk into the store, basically, you know, your phone, if you're using their Wi-Fi, they know what you're looking at and where you are. And it's just an amazing amount of intrusion, I think, into people's lives.
Yeah, this is definitely the new frontier when it comes to civil liberties, because as technology expands, I mean, obviously technology is always expanding, but it seems like it's happening rapidly now. Both in the private sector and the public sector, there will be new and creative ways to track information. Of course, the ACLU, we especially notice the public sector, but we pay attention to what's happening in the private sector as well. And this, it manifests itself in all kinds of ways, between this and DNA collection and collection of people's prescription drug information. And there are other examples that I'm leaving out, but the list goes on and on.
Let me ask you this, Andy, from a worker's perspective. I mean, I don't know if the police would want it, would not want it. I'm not sure what the police union or policemen in general, if they would want it. But I look at it from a worker perspective. You know, now you're talking about the potential of every moment of your day being recorded, and every moment that every moment being recorded. You know, I drive a truck on the weekends, you know, just to keep my CDL active. And I had gone away from driving for a couple of years. I come back to find that they've got cameras mounted on both sides of the windshield.
Wow.
And, you know, basically watching what you're doing on the road and watching what you're doing when you're sitting behind the wheel. And I go, you know, at some point, is this going to be the reality of every worker in this country, to where you got a camera staring in your face every minute of every day? Which is why when I see things like this, it kind of makes me a little leery.
Well, that's a good point. And we've had this conversation with some of the folks from the police union, the folks that lobby for them, and our position is that if the cameras are going to be used, they should be running during all encounters with the public, no turning it on and off. However, we put it that way because we do respect and believe that there needs to be workplace privacy for the officers. You know, two officers are sitting in their car, they're talking about union issues, or they're talking about department politics. You know, they need those privacy rights, because we kicked around the idea at the national level about whether or not to advocate for just continuous running of the cameras at all times, but we made the distinction because for that reason, we think there needs to be workplace privacy for the officers.
Yeah, and look, if we, because my concern is very simply this: if you're going to do it to them, they're the guinea pigs. That's the first step in the door. Once you get past the truck drivers, which is, you know, you look at the CDL, with national driver's license. Now we've got, you know, the Real ID Act, which they haven't really put into place yet. But still, the law is in place where there could be a national driver's license, where you're seeing all of this consolidation and all of this stuff. They usually pick a group to make them the, you know, they're the test case. And I look at this as that.
Well, yeah, and this is, we certainly keep an eye on where these issues are going. You know, there is some distinction between the private sector and the public sector, and the private sector, to the dismay of workers everywhere, has a lot more leeway, actually, in conducting this kind of surveillance. You know, we run into this with drug testing. We're dealing with a bill right now that would require all prospective school employees, public or private, to do a drug test. And we're arguing that public schools cannot do that. That's a taking of a biological sample, and thus it's a search. And as a public entity, the public schools cannot do that. Unfortunately, the private sector has more leeway to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, the ship has kind of sailed up, because we as society go, well, you know, I have nothing to hide. You know, you know how many false positives I've seen people get over the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true. And my standard answer to that is always innocent people should not have to give up their rights.
Absolutely. So let me ask you a last line of questioning. Where is this right now? Where is Senate Bill 1168? And is there any way, is it going to go forward, or is there any way for us to stop it? What should we be doing that line?
So the Senate Bill 1168 is probably not the bill that ultimately becomes law. There's another bill amending the Wiretap Act, Senate Bill 57, which is currently in the House. And this body-mounted camera language was amended into Senate Bill 57 by the House Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 57 is currently on the House calendar. Our hope is that someone in the House will take up an effort to amend it to include more protection. But I would encourage folks to call their state representative and ask them to oppose Senate Bill 57 in its current form because of this issue.
All righty. Andy Hoover, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
All right, thanks, Rick. Take care.
Thanks so much, Andy Hoover, legislative director for the Pennsylvania ACLU. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game? Master of the cloak and dagger.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got it!
Brian sent me an email during the break that, you know, it's one of these things that I got to read over real quick. It's this letter from one of these right-wing shill groups, Americans for Puppies or stuff, Limited Government or something. And this guy writes this piece about the minimum wage, which, you know, we talked about the other day. And had minimum wage kept up with productivity? And, you know, we talked about this. Had it kept up with productivity? The minimum wage would be about $21.72 an hour. Had it kept up with the growth of the 1%, it would be up over $22.60 an hour, 212% higher than it is right now. And the email I got said, you know, well, you know, this guy makes a good argument about why we shouldn't raise the minimum wage. His argument is basically this. And it's the same old canard, and I guess I have to go through it again. The argument against raising the minimum wage that this guy makes, and the email evidently believes, is that if you make the minimum wage too high, employers are going to mechanize. And they point to the fast food industry, which right now the fast food workers are saying, hey, you know, we're basically starving. You know, we can't afford to buy a Happy Meal in the place where we work. This guy's argument is that, well, if you make the minimum wage too high, what you'll end up with is everything mechanized. And the guy writes that Siri's younger, more advanced sister, and everyone knows Siri from the iPhone, she's going to, you know, take your order. Siri's going to do all of the work that the pimply-faced teenager who's getting their entry-level job for the very first time and learning work skills, that person's going to get mechanized right out of business, and then we'll be sorry. And I find it interesting that there's this belief that corporate America isn't, no matter what the wage is, isn't trying to figure out how to make humans redundant. I mean, Amazon has a drone that they think is going to deliver their packages. Even if you were paying a person a dollar to deliver that package, the drone's going to do it 24/7. The drone isn't going to get tired. Mechanization has nothing to do with the minimum wage. I know it makes a good argument, but look, the people who are going to mechanize are going to mechanize. So this view, and I know it's a very simplistic view to buy into. Well, you know, if we demand too much, they'll leave. If we demand too much, they'll just outsource my job. And I go, you know what? We can stop that. But he goes, this guy who writes the article says, you know, it takes a little imagination to see a fast food operation with very few people working in it. You know, everything down to the beverage, which they have mechanized already. I guess he doesn't know that, doesn't visit the McDonald's where I haven't seen a pimply-faced teenager in years. Where the cup just comes, you sign into the computer, the cup's already full, right there for the person to hand out the window. It's already mechanized. Not because that minimum wage is destroyed, because it cuts down on their labor costs no matter what it is. So you look at this, and the argument that they're making is the reason we have a low minimum wage is so these pimply-faced teenagers can get jobs. And the author goes back and looks at 1973. It says the economy was terrible. There were gas lines, oil embargoes, the economy reeling from much of the impact of Nixon's wage and price controls. 73 was a mess for those trying to get a job, yet more than half of teens were in the workforce. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that 46.9% of teens 16 to 19 in October of 73 were employed compared to 26.6 today. And I go, well, wait a second, hold on, stop. Again, you know, you got to go back. And the government had a bunch of programs that employed teenagers. We don't have those anymore. We've starved the beast on that. And understand, there were more manufacturing jobs. As a percentage of the economy, there were more jobs for people. And you also had not as many women in the workforce. You had women in the workforce, but not to the extent we have now. What we've seen since 1973, and I'm glad they brought that up, is you've seen a stagnation of wages. You've seen a destruction of the middle class. And it's interesting that 73 is the year that he picks, the first year of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. The year that most of the Powell memo suggestions began, the Heritage Foundation, a lot of those big think tanks, a lot of the money started flowing into doing what? Well, destroying wages, screwing up our economy. And what he concludes with is he says, it is time to just say no to those who would destroy our nation's entry-level jobs under the mantle of doubling wages at fast food or other retailers. After all, those jobs are for our kids. They're for our teen children. Go back and you look at the realities. The reality, less than a quarter of minimum wage workers are teenagers. And I don't know where this guy went to school. I don't know if he ever passed the math class, but that's not a majority. The reality is nearly 40% of minimum wage workers are over the age of 30. Trying to raise a family. You know, the minimum wage workers that I've met, I'm sorry, they don't fit the pimply-faced teenager model. They don't fit the, oh, this is just your first job, so you learn to show up on time, and you learn to, you know, the FICO score, you know, you need to learn what FICA is. And he goes into that, too, because you got to get a shot at government and taxes. I find it really just amazing that people would buy into this whole argument that, you know, if we don't have poverty wages, they'll mechanize. Now, think of this from a taxpayer's point of view. McDonald's, the fast food industry, we're talking billions of dollars in public subsidies, be it through food stamps, be it through Medicaid, be it through LIHEAP, be it through any of these programs. Now, the guy who wrote this article, I would imagine, would advocate for doing away with those programs so that McDonald's wouldn't get the subsidy. So but what does that mean for the worker? What does that mean for the person who's getting short-ended here? Well, it means they're screwed. And as I was thinking through this afternoon, there's part of me that, you know, and it's the sadistic part that says, you know what, maybe he's right. Maybe just let these people suffer until the point where they've finally had enough and they take to the streets. Oh, wait a minute. They have. They've had enough. They are taking to the streets. They are demanding. Wait a minute. We've hit that critical mass. We've hit that point where they've said, you know what? We've been desperate long enough. And I find it really very, very interesting that you've got now Americans for Limited Government or all these other shill groups out here peddling this nonsense that we can't raise the minimum wage and throwing the same old canards out there. If we raise the minimum, it'll cost us jobs. They'll flee the country. Yet study after study shows actually increasing people's wages creates more jobs, gives people disposable income. And then there's the other, which, you know, I always love. But Rick, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Yeah, I'll be one of the very few people who will say that very honestly. I think that it should be. I don't know that we need a billionaire class of over 1,000 billionaires whose wealth grows exponentially every year, and as a group gets wealthier and wealthier and controls a larger and larger share of the national pie. Sorry, I'm not quite there. I do believe that this country is strongest when we have shared broad prosperity. Not when you have a decade where productivity has gone up 25% and wages have actually gone backwards. Does that make sense to you? Doesn't make any sense to me. And it doesn't make any sense to me that we're cutting taxes while simultaneously running a city like Detroit through bankruptcy. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on in Detroit and what it means all around the country. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Email rick@ricksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is appealing a judge's decision to allow Detroit to proceed with the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. If the bankruptcy goes ahead, city workers could see their average $19,000 a year pensions be cut as low as $9,000 a year. AFSCME says it's a very scary day for Detroit citizens, especially city retirees. On Tuesday, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled in favor of State Emergency Manager Kevin Orr that the bankruptcy can proceed. In his opinion, Judge Rhodes said that under Michigan's Constitution, pension rights for city workers are treated like any other contract rights in a bankruptcy. And since the state is authorizing the bankruptcy, the pension rights can be cut or abridged like any other contract in a bankruptcy. Protesters at the courthouse when the ruling was made said the case was about busting unions, privatizing workers, and wiping out pensions. Michigan Republicans used their state emergency manager law to put Kevin Orr in charge in Detroit, which led to the bankruptcy filing. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says this is a dark day for the people of Detroit, and she said if Detroit wants to rebuild a strong economy, it needs to prioritize its workers and middle class over the interests of Wall Street. Weingarten says $19,000 a year pensions didn't cause Detroit's bankruptcy. Skyrocketing financial costs and a shrinking tax base did. Newly exposed documents published by the Guardian newspaper reveal plans by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to shield itself against lobbying laws while pushing a centralized state-by-state corporate agenda. The documents also reveal that ALEC is planning to require state lawmakers who join the group pledge an oath of loyalty to ALEC above any duty to their constituents. The Guardian also says ALEC is facing a funding crisis and is trying to get more than 40 major donors to return to the funding fold. Companies like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, Kraft, McDonald's, and Walmart left ALEC in the midst of the furor over the Trayvon Martin killing. ALEC is a main backer of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, like the one George Zimmerman used to get away with killing Martin. In Washington Tuesday, Fasters and the Fast for Families announced an expansion of the action. Four fasters have gone 22 days of a water-only fast to highlight the moral dimensions of the failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The long-term fasters were given blessed bread as they gave the crosses they have worn for the last 22 days to new long-term fasters. Fast for Families is being supported by a big group of organizations, clergy, and political leaders as the fasters urge the U.S. House to act on immigration reform. To support Workers Independent News and keep workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day, donate now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, to help build a strong middle class, to help educate our kids, and to make our lives better than all the programs of government combined.
We want it all, every last bit of it. Put it into the hands of the profiteers. Put it in the hands of Wall Street. And I look at what's going on in Detroit. Look at what went on in Illinois with the pension situation there. In Pennsylvania, you're next. But this thing in Detroit, the Romneyization of the nation, this whole, hey, let's run government like a business, right through Chapter 9 bankruptcy, wipe away all those legacy costs, screw all those workers, and, well, make sure that our contracts to the profiteers, well, we'll make sure we'll keep those. Sad, sad stuff. Well, how's our media been reporting this? That's the reason we've asked Craig Harrington from Media Matters for America to come talk to us. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again.
So I look at this bankruptcy, and first, I'm of the mindset that I really can't believe that we're in this position where the city's talking about, well, we're going to cut people's pension down to $9,000, $6,000 for a lifetime of work. It just blows my mind. But how's the media been portraying this?
Well, it's interesting, actually, that you mentioned the Romneyization of
of American government, where we have to run everything like a business. Because, as you know, in 2009, Mitt Romney infamously and then famously and then infamously and then famously stated that he would let Detroit go bankrupt. And when he said that, he meant he would allow the big three automakers, the American industrial titans, to collapse under the weight of the financial crisis. But in the last couple of days, with the city of Detroit getting a judge's authorization to proceed with its own bankruptcy filing, what we've seen in the right-wing media is this clarion call that, in fact, Mitt Romney was correct all along, and he had predicted the bankruptcy. He was using Detroit, in air quotes, as a euphemism for the auto industry, but the right-wing media has trumpeted up this charge that, you know, if only we had elected this really prescient guy, this guy who had predicted the future, this philosopher king Mitt Romney, we would all be better off. It's something that Simon Malloy actually just wrote about on Media Matters earlier today. The right wing is really trying to push this Romney predicted Detroit's bankruptcy thing. But the fact is that the city has been insolvent for years, and Judge Rhodes, the federal judge who decided on Tuesday that Detroit could in fact go through with a bankruptcy proceeding, he announced in his 140-page opinion on the matter and in his statement to the court that this is something Detroit probably should have done years ago. The city has been in a state of some sort of insolvency, or the city has been in a state of some sort of insolvency for quite some time. The problem is the media portraying this as a problem of the unions and a problem of the workers. What we're talking about in Detroit is a few thousand retirees and current workers who are going to have dramatic, draconian cuts to their pensions. It's something like 20,000 retirees, 10,000 current employees who are nearing retirement. So the total number of people who are being blamed for destroying this great American city is a few thousand people. And they're not possibly able to, librarians and police officers and firefighters and school teachers who have these public pensions through robust public employee unions, they can't possibly be bankrupting Detroit. And in fact, when you look at it, it's an $18 billion bankruptcy filing. Only about $3.5 billion of it is unfunded pension. And the entire reason that Detroit is in this crisis is because the city is in decay. People are moving out of the city, the tax base and the population are declining, and it's a generational trend. It's not something librarians have forced on us.
No,
it's not fat cat union. It's just the economy.
Well,
it's not policy, it's economic.
Right. For me, it's much deeper than just the economy. It's the entire neoliberal trade agenda that we've had for the last 30 years. It's deindustrialization. It's shipping our jobs overseas and giving tax breaks to big corporations that have gutted not just Detroit, but most of our major industrial cities across this country who are struggling with the same kind of things, that they don't have the tax base and the jobs anymore because we've allowed them to leave.
That's absolutely true. What we see in Detroit is sort of the perfect storm for an American municipal insolvency. And that's why it is by orders of magnitude, by hundreds of times, it is the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. Because Detroit was at one point a city with 1.8 million people. You know, in the 1950s, I think 1952 is the year that comes to mind. Something like 25% of the world's GDP passed through Detroit. This is a city that was absurdly wealthy just 60 years ago. But deindustrialization, globalization, neoliberal economic advancement, and, of course, suburban sprawl and white flight and various other things have affected its socioeconomic demographics such that the city just doesn't exist today the way it existed before. How can you expect 700,000 mostly impoverished residents in Detroit to fund an entire city scheme that was built for 1.8 million people? When this city was built, when it was created as a modern Mecca in the 50s and 60s, there were 2 million people living there. Now the metro area has 5 million residents, but none of them live in Detroit. They don't pay taxes in Detroit. They don't engage in commerce in Detroit. That is the entire reason. That is the whole reason that the city is in the state of bankruptcy that it is now. And the thing that I published earlier on Media Matters cited research from the Economic Policy Institute and from Demos. These are nonpartisan research tanks, and they all came to the same conclusion. It's not a policy where union thugs got robust pensions for a bunch of lazy workers. It's simply that the economy in Detroit abandoned its own city.
Right, but out of
and
this,
as a result,
what you're going to end up with is you're going to end up with these people who worked their entire lives, were promised something in retirement, and you're going to see upwards of a 60% cut in what they were promised. And I got to be honest, to me that's a violation of the contract. And you know, I go back, and since you brought up the auto industry. If you listen to most to Mitt Romney and most of the real far out right wing conservatives who are angry about helping the auto industry, their real complaint, because they all say, well, eventually they went through bankruptcy, yeah, eventually, but those workers got to keep their pensions or part of their pensions. And I keep coming back to this: what is it about the people on the conservative political side, the Republican side, the right wing side, that so greatly hates workers and their pensions? Because every time I turn around, this is what we're seeing. The argument is, well, they have pensions, we should take them. They didn't get their pensions taken, they should have. It just seems to me that there's a common thread here, Craig.
There's a fundamental misunderstanding with a lot of right wing media personalities and a lot of conservative media pundits. When they talk about pensions and they talk about employee pensions and how they're protected through a bankruptcy, or in the case of Detroit, how they're not protected through a bankruptcy, they often get angry that employees get to, quote, keep their pensions, because they think of pensions in the same way as you think of a 401k, which is a defined contribution program where you input a certain amount of money and it's like an investment. What these public employee pensions have are defined benefit programs. They are paying in a robust amount of their salary, and they are guaranteed to get it back when they retire. It's not a 401k. It's not an investment strategy. It's not something that could be liable to the market fluctuations. That's why they entered into these programs instead of other ones. They're supposed to keep them, even if there's a financial crisis, even if there's an economic downturn. That's why they argued, and that's why they used collective bargaining to get these defined benefit programs. And now, with the help of a complacent judiciary and just a dramatic economic crisis that's been going on for years, and in Detroit for decades, they're now losing. You know, the employees whose ancestors, whose fathers and grandfathers had fought to create strong unions so that they could have these benefit programs, the right wing wants to get after them, because for them it's just dollars and cents. If an investor is going to lose 10% of his billions, then a librarian who spent 35 years helping citizens of Detroit, that person should be forced to lose 10% of what is essentially just a benefit that's barely keeping them out of poverty.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen numbers upwards of 60% of their pension. You're talking about the average pensioner being somewhere between $15,000 and $20,000. 60% of $15,000 is you know, a whole ton of money and a lifestyle change. So let me ask you this, you know, and looking forward, because now I'm looking at Detroit as the model for the rest of the Cleveland, the Milwaukee, the other cities that were industrial powerhouses that are now struggling a little bit. Is this the model that they're going to follow? You're going to have states that are going to be starving these municipalities just to run them through bankruptcy, to screw workers out of their pensions? And really, is this going to be the end of pensions for workers going forward?
It's hard to hypothesize that far out. If I had the ability to prognosticate on that sort of issue, I'd probably be playing in the stock market. But Media Matters, we got in contact with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, back in July when Detroit first went through its bankruptcy filing. Myself and our senior economic researcher, Robert Klein, we had an interview with him, and he specifically mentioned that Detroit is a very particular case. Like I said, Detroit is a city that once had nearly three times the population, and adjusting for inflation, you're talking about 5, 10, 15 times the gross domestic product. So whether or not Detroit as a specific example, could be applied to a Cleveland or a Chicago is a little bit dicey. The right-wing media certainly wants Detroit to be a harbinger of municipal collapses all across the country. But the fact is, Detroit is in a specific and particular state of economic insolvency that we don't really see anywhere else. You know, you have the issue where the state of Illinois is flirting with going after pensions in that state. The state of Pennsylvania has made the same flirtations, but no one is quite as bad off as Detroit. And the terrible thing about Detroit is if the media would offer any space to talk about policies that were proactive and progressive
right.
and would help build the city, we could actually find a way to institute federal government and state government money into Detroit to rebuild that city so that it could sustain itself and pay us back. Instead, we're all losing. And, you know, the right-wing media, you have Charles Payne on Fox News saying that, you know, this bankruptcy is great for taxpayers. Well, first of all, there are 700,000 taxpayers in Detroit, and it's not great for them. And those of us who have been paying into a federal tax system that has been in some ways subsidizing Detroit all this time, you know, we're essentially cutting losses. That doesn't make sense.
No,
these are American citizens who live in this country. We should be helping them. We should be helping them help themselves as opposed to just cutting bait and hoping to avoid the calamity in the future.
Yeah. You know, I look at this, and when I first saw the news come out, this is what I'm sure Pennsylvania and other states are going to use to say, see, it's those pensions. It's killed us. We've got to cut those. Even here in Pennsylvania, where they've already admitted that the defined contribution is a failure. It's going to cost us tons of money. It's going to produce less benefit. It's a horrible situation all the way around, but we should do it because it's ideologically right.
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
That's the problem that we see. And the media plays into it, too. The media thinks that, you know, that we should be going to 401k area instead of to the hard pension area. They think that we should be, they think that everyone should have this terrible Orwellian term. And even President Obama has said it, at least when he was a candidate, that this term of having skin in the game, this sort of disgusting imagery that all of us should get flayed if someone's going to lose. And the fact is, the people are getting hurt the most. They can't afford. What are they going to do? They're already cutting their pills in half. What are they going to do, cut them in thirds?
Yeah.
And when that specific anecdote, when that example gets on television, even in the right-wing media, you have the right-wing pundits who say, oh, well, that's a tragedy. That individual who is barely avoiding starvation on their current pension, it's a tragedy that he's taking his haircut. But the unions are to blame. No one ever brings up the banksters or the financial fraud or the financial collapse that none of us had anything to do with.
Yeah, I'm not looking for. To me, the answer is jobs. And you know, I go back to 2010.
Absolutely.
Go back to 2010 when the Republicans told us laser-like focus. Yet I've yet to see anything that would come out of any of them that would have anything to do with creating a job. It's all been divisiveness and division. And while they're playing their petty politics, we've got a major U.S. city that's been struggling, as you pointed out, for years, and they've done nothing, literally nothing. In fact, I would argue what they've done is to make things worse, to hasten their demise, let alone to help.
Well, someone's getting paid to write Ted Cruz's speeches, and those 43 drafts of Obamacare repeal legislation, that created at least one job. So they can always rest on their laurels, if nothing else.
There you go. Well, maybe we should ship some of the jobs to Detroit to help those folks out. Craig, I always appreciate you coming on and talking to us about what's going on in the media. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Craig Harrington, Media Matters for America. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Irony is dead. It has been garroted by reality. For proof, check out the Beverage Institute for Health and Wellness. Sounds like a spa in Arizona where you might enjoy a cleansing regimen of aloe vera smoothies, doesn't it? But no, it's a hokey science front owned and run by Coca-Cola. The world's largest beverage purveyor wants you to be assured that none of its sugary, empty calorie, or artificially sweetened concoctions are a cause of obesity. Hey, shouts Coke's instituters, three or more colas a day are simply a part of an integrated healthy diet for children and adults alike. There is no scientific evidence that connects sugary beverages to obesity, snapped a top Coke executive, adding that we don't believe in empty calories. Oh, well then, okay. But in the off chance that you might want a more independent scientific source, try the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, billed as the world's largest organization of food and nutrition professionals. But wait, while the AND is not owned by Coke, it does lease out its integrity to the cola giant. Coca-Cola is listed on the Academy's website as a generous sponsor and partner in its scientific work. In fact, the Academy certifies Coke's Beverage Institute as an official provider of, quote, continuing education for registered dietitians. How neat! A corporation that profiteers by peddling nutritionally worthless and health-endangering products finances the academic outfit that's most responsible for educating Americans about healthy foods, and that academy, in turn, embraces the corporate fiction that sugary drinks pose no health problems. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's not irony. It's shameful corruption. The greatest obesity crisis in America is not the cola itself, but the fat-headed ethics of single-minded corporate profiteers and their apologists.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline, groceries, and our haces. Everything's raising but the wages.
No, he's actually right. Now, I spent a lot of time in Detroit back in the mid to late 80s. I went to school out in western Ohio, and you know, you just shot up the road of I-75 into Detroit there. And you know, we spent a lot of time there, and then the city was struggling because what you had is you had the auto industry, and this goes back to really the movement of the auto industry, and this is where you know this whole idea that these big companies, they it's about putting money in their pocket. The fact that, you know, these workers were making a decent wage, hey, let's go find somewhere else so we can cut these people's jobs. And our policies allowed it. And, you know, I think back to, and we bring up this whole neoliberal trade agenda, which, you know, back in the, you know, the 70s, you know, they came up with this idea of, well, we need to, really back in the 60s, but it took hold in the 70s, and Reagan, during the Reagan years, man, they just full bore, and then you hit Bush, and it's all been downhill since then. But the idea of tearing down capital borders, in years ago, if you wanted to invest in a country, you were able to invest, but there were barriers to you to fleeing. And there were always, you know, countries wanted to make sure that they had control of what went on in their country. What's gone on over the last 40, 50 years is you've seen those barriers destroyed. Capital now has the ability to free flow around the world. And I always point to Argentina. You know, after 9/11, what happened in Argentina is all the hot money left. And right up until its collapse, the right wing in this country was saying, Argentina is the free market capital of the world. They're doing everything right. And then bang, boom, bang, they're done. Factories chained up, workers actually cutting the chains and taking over the factories and getting them started so that they can have jobs. And then once they were back up and running, the capitalists came in and said, we want our factories back. and use the power of government to take them back. But I think back to Detroit, you know, when I was younger, and, you know, even then it was a city with a high poverty rate. It was a city that was struggling. And, you know, you had voices back then saying, you know, this deindustrialization, this shipping our jobs overseas is a bad idea. But then again, you had Reagan with his high dollar policy who said, well, you know what, we want to make sure. And again, it goes back to policy. You go back to the Reagan era where we had this high dollar policy that made our exports much more expensive and made imports cheaper, basically signaling, going, go ahead, we want you to leave. So I look at Detroit and I go, you know, this, you know, Craig's right. It has been a couple of generations of free fall. And once you look at what the state of Michigan had done, you know, and as you pointed out, the flight and all of that, it's an absolute shame. And I hope Craig's right that this isn't the model that they pursue for other industrial cities that have fallen on hard times because of the jobs being shipped overseas. But, you know, I go back and I think about this, and it does. It comes back down to policy. It comes back down to what we do or what we don't do. You know, they were calling for help years ago. And now what the frame is, and Craig's right, the frame is it's these handful of union people who worked their entire lives, sacrificed their entire lives for low pay, so they would have a $15,000 a year pension at the end of the road. And now they're going to take 60% of that? Really? You're going to end up with a $6,000 pension when you thought you were getting 15? I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound right. And I know it's the business-friendly mentality. I know it's the Romney way. But it's not right. I mean, at some point, don't we have to talk about right and wrong? Don't we have to talk about contracts? Keeping your word? But I guess that doesn't matter in corporate America. And the sad thing is that's what we've really done here. Now, what we may see in the coming days, weeks, and months, I know there's a challenge going on, but at the end of it, who ends up holding the bag? Not the very well-to-do. Roger Smith is not any less well-off. And it was Roger Smith, the former chairman of General Motors, who, I gotta say, probably made a good number of these decisions to move manufacturing out of this country. And we talked earlier about the trade deficits. This is the result of those enormous trade deficits. This is what $30 billion a month in trade deficits with China has brought us. This is what, over the last, since 1975, $18 trillion in trade deficits, that's what it's brought us. I mean, really, you know, when you're running these massive trade deficits year after year, and you're hemorrhaging jobs year after year, and you're handing out tax dollars year after year to these companies who are pitting one city against another city, a state against another state, there's something wrong. And it, to me, it goes back to Congress. You got to stop it. But as long as the moneyed interests want it, I don't know that it stops. And I'm saddened to see one of a formerly great American city that when we went through on the People's Tour for America, that when we went and we saw what had happened to the city, where they're literally bulldozing neighborhoods. It was a sad sight. and now this. And I go back, you know, there's the part of me that is a little jaded, that looks at this and says, you know, this is the model that they're going to pursue in other places, that they're going to continue to create these crises, continue to starve these municipalities. And then, well, at the end of the road, go, well, like we do in business. Well, we've run up enough debt, it's time to wipe it clean. Wipe the slate clean, come out the other side, and oh, by the way, it's those people who created the wealth and did the work for us. It's those people who are going to struggle. They're going to suffer. I mean, you look at company after company who've thrown their pensions on the back of the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. It's what they do. Amazing, amazing stuff. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, and talk with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees is appealing a judge's decision to allow Detroit to proceed with the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. If the bankruptcy goes ahead, city workers could see their average $19,000 a year pensions be cut as low as $9,000 a year. AFSCME says it's a very scary day for Detroit citizens, especially city retirees. On Tuesday, Judge Stephen Rhodes ruled in favor of State Emergency Manager Kevin Orr that the bankruptcy can proceed. In his opinion, Judge Rhodes said that under Michigan's Constitution, pension rights for city workers are treated like any other contract rights in a bankruptcy. And since the state is authorizing the bankruptcy, the pension rights can be cut or abridged like any other contract in a bankruptcy. Protesters at the courthouse when the ruling was made said the case was about busting unions, privatizing workers, and wiping out pensions. Michigan Republicans used their state emergency manager law to put Kevin Orr in charge in Detroit, which led to the bankruptcy filing. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says this is a dark day for the people of Detroit, and she said if Detroit wants to rebuild a strong economy, it needs to prioritize its workers and middle class over the interests of Wall Street. Weingarten says $19,000 a year pensions didn't cause Detroit's bankruptcy. Skyrocketing financial costs and a shrinking tax base did. Newly exposed documents published by the Guardian newspaper reveal plans by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, to shield itself against lobbying laws while pushing a centralized state-by-state corporate agenda. The documents also reveal that ALEC is planning to require state lawmakers who join the group pledge an oath of loyalty to ALEC above any duty to their constituents. The Guardian also says ALEC is facing a funding crisis and is trying to get more than 40 major donors to return to the funding fold. Companies like Amazon, Coca-Cola, General Electric, Kraft, McDonald's, and Walmart left ALEC in the midst of the furor over the Trayvon Martin killing. ALEC is a main backer of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws, like the one George Zimmerman used to get away with killing Martin. In Washington Tuesday, Fasters in the Fast for Families announced an expansion of the action. Four fasters have gone 22 days of a water-only fast to highlight the moral dimensions of the failure to enact comprehensive immigration reform. The long-term fasters were given blessed bread as they gave the crosses they have worn for the last 22 days to new long-term fasters. Fast for Families is being supported by a big group of organizations, clergy, and political leaders, as the fasters urge the U.S. House to act on immigration reform. To support Workers Independent News and keep workers and their unions on the National Radio News airwaves every day, donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So the big news, ISA going after the Affordable Care Act again, huh?
I think this guy must live, eat, and breathe to see what he can say in his next hearing. And I've heard from Republicans that they're just tired of it, that they think that he's looking very cantankerous and not helpful.
Well, I mean, they're trying to find some there, and there's, well, nothing there.
Well, that's true, and he's also just trying. I mean, it's like he's obsessed. And, you know, it was interesting. We've had some people try and invest and think about talk radio news, and I always tell them, you know, I know you're interested in X, Y, or Z, but you can't ask a question every single time about X, Y, or Z. You have to mix it up, or people just begin to write you off. Every time you open your mouth, they know what you're going to say.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, I've also seen, and maybe you've got some more information on this than what I'm seeing, is, you know, there are some Republicans in the House that are back to the impeachment thing.
Well, that's right, and they think they have enough to impeach him in the House. I mean, give me a break. It's going to go anywhere into the Senate?
But is it now just about, I mean, have we, you know, I go back to the Clinton years, and I'll be honest, I mean, my view on it, and you don't have to agree with me, but my view on 9/11 happened because we went through this whole kangaroo court of impeachment and attack. While we had our ball, I focused on this bouncing ball over here, everything else was going to pot.
I do think there was an inordinate amount of focus on Clinton and his personal and this, that, and the other. And honestly, this is going to even surprise you more. If they hadn't gone after Clinton the way they had the first, you know, 4 years of his presidency, I think that he might have been impeached.
Yeah.
Because I think even the Democrats would have bought into it. But they went into him with such a degree that by the time this came along with Monica Lewinsky, they just kind of said, you're just going after him again. It's just unfair.
Yeah, but I look at this and I go, don't we have anything better to do? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, there is so much that needs to be done, so much that needs to just, any farm bill? Did we get this fixed yet? I mean.
Well, the farm bill, Debbie Stabenow and the ranking Republican, I mean, the chairman of the Ag Committee in the House, look like they are in agreement on a lot of things. We still have the corn folks and the soybean folks that are adding to things dramatically, to say the least.
So are they still, I mean, and maybe what you've heard, are they still talking about gutting $40 billion from food stamps? Are they talking about gutting
the SNAP? I don't know where the food stamp, they're not saying. I mean, that's the thing. Today they met with reporters, but they looked happier, but they're not saying what they're planning on doing.
Because I got to be honest with you, you know, tis the season to be jolly, this season of charity and giving and goodwill to man, and yet here at the end of this year, we're literally talking about stealing food out of the mouths of children, and we've got people running around saying that it would be good for them? Really? Are you kidding me? You know, I'm finishing up writing the conclusion to this book that we're working on. And one of the things that I remember as a kid, because I talk about the neighbor who got a union job at Ford, and how, to me, that guy getting that union job meant they had food at the end of the month. That's how basic and how primal I remember things being. And I see folks who are just struggling to exist with the food stamps that we have now. And I can't imagine stealing that back from them.
Well, honestly, I really can't either. But this is why, in some degree, I think the farm bill, the good thing about the crazy Republicans and the crazy Republican farmers, honestly, is they don't want those food stamp provisions taken out of the farm bill. That comes directly out of their pocket in terms of what they can sell in terms of ag products.
Yeah.
So the interest of the farmers and the farm lobby is not to get rid of food stamps. That is really a sort of a Republican innovation insanity.
Yeah, you know, I go back and I use the Eisenhower quote quite often because I think it's quite appropriate. When he wrote to his brother, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, eliminate labor laws, and farm programs, you would not hear from that political party again in our history. But he says there's a tiny splinter group, few oil billionaires, a couple of businessmen, but their numbers are negligible and they're stupid. But here we are talking about unemployment, the emergency unemployment being ended at the end of the year, the farm bill, not the farm programs, you know, if it's not re-upped by the end of the year, Social Security, they want to put on a chain CPI and cut that. I mean, is stupid running our country?
The chain CPI is another example of how that is really mainly aimed not so much at younger poor people, but the chain CPI is aimed at retirees.
Yeah, and going after you and people who are near retirement age.
Right.
I'm
near there.
Just amazing, amazing stuff. I understand the Washington State Insurance Commissioner, a guy named Mike Kreidler, testified before the House Ways and Means Committee today. What do you have to say?
And he certainly did. And basically what he said is he is opposed to the Obama administration giving any extra time to these insurance companies to develop and to give substandard policies that in Washington State they have 100,000 people that have signed up for what's now called Obamacare, and 150,000 people have signed up and are waiting for their approval. So he said he, as insurance commissioner, is not in favor.
And nor should they be. I mean, at the end of this, you know, the reality is had the states picked up the ball like they were supposed to and set up their own state-based exchange, a very Republican idea, this whole idea of state control and setting up your own system, which I would have thought, you know, I guess if you were thinking that they were actually rational, that they would have gone, yeah, this is our idea. The whole, I got to be honest, the whole Obamacare, that's all their idea, but even still.
As you pointed out, it's Heritage Foundation.
Exactly. And you would think that, you know, that they would go, oh, hey, we can make the states work and then we can have the competition between the states. And no, it's just because it's Obamacare. And I saw this poll not too long ago that said when people said, do you like the Affordable Care Act? People said, yes. Do you like Obamacare? No. Quite interesting.
Yes. And that is an example of just pure mainstream press and right-wing press trying to make a point and calling it Obamacare and then going after Obama.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know. But, you know, I want to go back to ICE's committee hearing, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee's hearing. You know, he's concerned with government picking winners and losers. You know, when I read that, I'm going, you don't seem to have a problem giving huge handouts to these companies who offshore jobs. Isn't that picking winners and losers? Only, you know, really big winners?
Well, yes. I mean, the point is that it's not just that they do it with. It's government contracting where they pick winners and losers. It's how they support a certain khaki corporation in terms of government military contracting. Come on. Yeah, the government's been picking winners and losers from the get-go.
You know, but one of the things I found interesting is one of the people they had testified, this senior fellow from George Mason University, which, you know, it has a very, very nice size right-wing kind of think tank there, saying that, well, there's no incentives for Obamacare, for the program to succeed. And it shows the fundamental flaw that government intervention proves out to be. And I'm going, well, wait a second. Isn't this what the right keeps talking about, the private-public partnerships, where, you know, understand, healthcare.gov was a public-private partnership. We handed it off to 55 private corporations, and they boogered it up.
Well, that's exactly. I mean, you and I agree that it should have been something like people buying into Medicare. But that would have been too radical of a step for anybody to say that really needed to be what happened.
Yeah.
And then they would have moaned and groaned that we would put all these good private companies out of business.
Are we going to see aliens anytime soon?
We might see aliens, but we're first probably going to see some microbes. So there was a hearing today at the House Science Committee, and quite shocking, that's run by Republicans, that they had a professor from MIT, his name is Stacy, you have it, and basically the professor said if one out of every five
stars is like a sun, and they each have an Earth equivalent. And if we are going to find life on one of these, it may only be microbes, is impending.
What I found interesting is the guy who's the committee chairman, this Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas, evidently said, you know, discovery depends on time and funding, and his committee has vowed to spend more time and money on this? Really?
Well, you know, there have been people, particularly people of my generation who are a little older than you, Rick Smith, that remember that America was sort of held and stitched together by the space program. Not only did the space program discover everything from Velcro to GPS,
and Tang,
but the space program, Tang, of course, was something that we were proud of as a country. And so people put a lot of money into that. It also generated a lot of jobs.
I'm not against it.
And that's right. And so some people believe we ought to continue what was a great investment for America.
I'm with you, but here's the thing. When we're talking about literally taking food out of the mouths of children, I find it a bit disingenuous to say we're going to put more money into looking for microbes or aliens when we've got kids right here who are going hungry. I have a fundamental problem with that.
Well, yes and no. I don't disagree with exactly how you're thinking. But the two are not mutually exclusive, particularly if the space program produces a lot of education and jobs for middle America, which it did in the 60s.
I'm absolutely with you, and I'm not arguing that point, but it just seems interesting to me. It just does.
Well, I would sure as heck rather put it in space exploration and developing jobs than stick it into either the very wealthy, and the president made a speech about that today, and then not putting it into a lot of military hardware, which also does create jobs, but doesn't exactly make for a peaceful world.
And I understand Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary, said that I guess they're going to be cutting the Pentagon budget by 20% in 2014?
They're not cutting the whole Pentagon budget. What they're doing is cutting the budget, the sort of administrative budget. They're not cutting our rank-and-file military people who are on bases all over this country. They're cutting people in the Pentagon who are a lot of administrators. Probably needs to be cut, I got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, going back to the space thing, I think we were having kind of a heated agreement. I think we should be investing in that kind of stuff. I think that what we did to NASA was a shame. I think we should be investing in lots of technology that we're going to have better educational opportunities, better investments. My problem is that, you know, here we're, it seems like if we're broke and we don't have money, the kid thing just sticks with me.
But the point is that we actually do have money to pay for food stamps. We actually do have money to pay for education. It's a question of whether that becomes a national priority.
And that is it. And finally, I understand the vice president had a very lengthy meeting with the Chinese today.
That's right, with the Chinese premier. It went on for 5.5 hours in various variations, including basically sort of a one-on-one with just a few staff people and translators, and some other sort of larger meetings. They talked about everything from the World Trade Organization to what they're going to do about North Korea to China trying to demand some issues over those islands, which are just insane, that they're fighting with Japan about, and a little bit of what's going on in Syria, and of course North Korea. All of that came together today.
All righty. So is this?
Yeah, I just want to say one other thing, Rick Smith, which is pretty amazing. I had a cab driver the other day, and I noticed he had a very sort of educated accent. I said, "Where are you from?" Well, he's from one of the Middle Eastern countries. I'm not going to mention because I want to pinpoint the guy. And I had the same cab driver today. Turns out, as I found out yesterday, he had been a diplomat from his country. He was like assistant secretary at the embassy, wherever. And he did serve in the United States for 4 years, but he also served in North Korea. And he said it was so bad there that
know, they had food and they had a place and, you know, they had heat and all that. But it was so bad in that country that he wanted to kill himself, just
wow.
seeing these people. I thought that was pretty amazing. So they just never treated their own people well at all.
And you wonder, sometimes at some point you wonder, how much are they willing to take? Or, you know, at some point, don't they rise up? Or, I don't know. I can't say what I would do.
If you don't have enough nutrition in your body, it's very hard to rise up.
Yeah. Sad
And that's
stuff.
Why we have to make sure that our people have enough nutrition in their body.
I'm right there with you. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate taking the time.
Thank you.
Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together we will live on forevermore. In the plan we have defended, from all things dark and cruel. Now we are defenses.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of truck and deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who was willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see a resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tilt my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Smile and green is a change all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. A couple of things today in U.S. history. It was 1783. George Washington delivered the farewell address to his officers in New York City. Also, 1816, James Monroe of Virginia was elected by electors to be the fifth president of the United States. And it was today, 1945, that the U.S. Senate approved its participation in the United Nations. Also, today's the day that Frank Zappa died at the age of 52 of cancer. The year was 1993. I can't believe 20 years ago. Man, time flies. Also today in history, 1943, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt announced the end of the Works Progress Administration, ending its four-year run of creating jobs for folks who needed it. And you think about all of the projects that came out of it, the legacy of highways and public buildings and all of the things that, all of the assets that we, the people, benefited from when he created about 8.5 million million jobs. We could probably use something like that kind of today, don't you think? With all of the people that are unemployed and still looking for work. Also today in history, W.H. Rivers, the well-known psychiatrist, he presented his report, The Repression of War Experience, where he termed the coined the term shell shock, where he went to the Craig Lockhart Psychiatric Hospital there in England and saw these guys who were, oddly enough, suffering from really debilitating illnesses and, you know, all of this stuff from being near war. And, you know, it had come out of this idea that, you know, the bombardment, the people on the front lines, they would suffer from this. But what they found through this hospital, this really horrible place, evidently, is that you had people who were just had seen too much, and their minds just went, and you know, including debilitating anxiety, persistent nightmares, physical afflictions ranging from diarrhea to loss of sight. When appearing, even, you know, in soldiers who hadn't seen the front lines, but had seen the bombardment. A couple of the very famous soldiers during that time who were treated in this hospital for shell shock. Now, remember, the idea of this hospital was to get people back to the front, get them back to the war. According to numbers, one in five actually who were treated at the hospital actually went back to military duty. One of the people that was treated there, a poet named Wilfred Owens, wrote of one of his fellow inmates at this psychiatric hospital. He wrote, "These are men whose minds the dead have ravished, memory fingers in their hair of murders, multitudinous murders they had once witnessed." And that, well, things haven't changed much. Just the language has gotten a little softer. So we no longer say it's shell shocked or battle fatigue was the next one. It's now post traumatic stress disorder. Maybe if we called it shell shock, maybe we'd get some more attention. And you know, as I was talking to a friend earlier today, and you know, it's amazing how we wave the flag and put people up on pedestals when they're bleeding, but once they're injured and maimed and broken, we don't seem to do a whole lot to help them. I'm hoping that changes. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone, I'll take the program on the go. If you missed any portion of the program, you go get that right there. Lots of good stuff tonight. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming.
Thank you.
grow dark in the midnight sky. We feel the fire burn.